Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at Severance from 2006, created by Dan Erickson and directed by Ben Stiller and... Oh, wait, wrong Severance. This isn't the popular dystopian sci-fi office satire from 2022, it's an entirely different dystopian office satire written by James Moran and directed by Christopher Smith. Both men were at the beginning of their careers when they made this movie, with Smith having directed one previous feature, Creep, not the semi-improvised horror comedy starring Mark Duplass, but a different film with the same title, and Moran having nothing more than a short film called Cheap Rate Gravity to his name. And both would go on to bigger and better things, with Moran writing for Doctor Who and Torchwood, as well as the cult film Cockneys vs. Zombies, and Smith directing the features Triangle, Black Death, and Consecration, among others. According to an interview with Moran for the special edition DVD, the genesis of the film came from his own time in corporate hell, returning from a frustrating day at the office and exorcising his anger with a cathartic screenplay about his least favorite yuppie stereotypes getting murdered in a variety of horrible ways. But I think there's another very obvious influence on this movie, one that would have been almost a little too on the nose at the time of its release, the 2001 BBC series The Office, created by Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant. Now, most American audiences think they're familiar with The Office because the series was remade for American television and lasted a whopping 9 seasons, making stars out of most of its regulars. But the key thing to remember about the American version is they wound up softening most of its satire because when the first season came out, audiences hated the characters and didn't enjoy spending time with them. That was the intention of Gervais and Merchant, who really wanted to show how loathsome and contemptible office politics genuinely were and didn't want anyone thinking that boss David Brent had any redeeming characteristics, and I think in hindsight, it's more appropriate than anybody realized that he's played by Gervais himself, but that kind of vicious mockery was more suited to British television, where a show could run for just 1 or 2 seasons and be a complete work, than in America, where the goal is to make the jump to syndicated reruns. Or was. Streaming has obviously changed everything, but it's still telling that the biggest binge watches are old sitcoms produced under the old model of delivery. The point is, anyone who is a, carbon-based life form in the UK would have been aware of The Office when this film was being made. Ditto the movie Wrong Turn, which had yet to be turned into a 7-film series, but did have a very strong and popular first entry. As well as The Hills Have Eyes from 1977, which was getting a remake right around this time, as well as the 1972 film Deliverance, as well as 2005's The Descent, as well as I Spit on Your Grave, as well as, look, the whole big city types decide to go out for a carefully curated wilderness experience and run into brutal hardened survivalists who have lost their humanity out in the wild is a pretty broad genre, okay? This is basically a movie that was bound to happen sooner or later, is what I'm saying. And because The Office was the model of comedy they had in mind for the comic aspects, and because they were a British film production casting in the UK where talented British comedians were thick on the ground during this period, they had their pick of talented actors for the roles they wanted to fill. The leader of this particular corporate retreat, for example, the incompetent and socially awkward Richard, is played by a genuine legend of the genre, Tim McInerney. McInerney has over 100 credits in film and television, including Game of Thrones, Eddie the Eagle, 101 Dalmatians, and Notting Hill, but he's always going to be most famous for his role as Percy Darling in the iconic and eternal British comedy Blackadder. No matter how much time changes him, you can instantly recognize him the moment he gets that befuddled look on his face. Playing Richard's foil, the arrogant and argumentative salesman Harris, is Toby Stevens. Stevens is best known for his stage acting, which he greatly prefers according to IMDb, but he has taken a big Hollywood role or two just to pay the bills, and he would have probably been most recognizable at the time for his role as villain Gustav Graves in the James Bond movie Die Another Day. He's since gone on to play Bond himself in a series of very well-received radio plays for the BBC, and he's currently appearing as Poseidon in the Percy Jackson and the Olympian series for Disney+. The fawning office toady of the group, Gordon, is played by Andy Nyman. Nyman's done a metric ton of voice work, most notably for Shaun the Sheep, where he's the voice of Nuts, and Chuggington, where he's the voice of Dunbar, but horror fans would probably recognize him best from the iconic miniseries Dead Set, about a zombie apocalypse that hits right in the middle of a season of Big Brother. He plays coked-up producer Patrick, and thinking of that show and this movie together should give you a pretty good idea of his astonishing range as a performer. Playing the immensely sweet, should-have-been-the-survivor Billy, spoilers, is Babu Cisse, who was born in London but spent much of his childhood in West Africa, according to Wikipedia. It feels very disrespectful to me to just say, oh, you know, one of those 16 countries that spans something like 2 million square miles, but there are probably better opportunities to complain about the way Europeans and Americans treat Africa as a monoculture. This was Cisse's first role in film or television, but he's gone on to a number of small roles and guest appearances that have gradually worked him up to bigger and better things, and he was most recently a lead in the TV series We Hunt Together. Since I haven't seen it, I can neither confirm nor deny that it's like Ramalamalama Kadingadadingadong. Playing Jill, who you're also rooting for right up until she gets it worse than just about anybody, again, spoilers, is Claudie Blakely, a working actor with heaps of credits in all sorts of British TV series from Playing the Field to Vital Signs to something called Lark Rise to Candleford, which may be the most British-sounding title ever. She was also in the movie Gosford Park for Robert Altman, playing Mabel Nesbitt, and is still working to this day, with her most recent appearance being in the show Father Brown. Playing determined survivor Maggie is Laura Harris, a Canadian actor who got her start doing all those American shows filmed in Canada that we love so much. She was in Mantis, The X-Files, Highlander, and Poltergeist the Legacy, before she made the leap to Hollywood with appearances in Suicide Kings and The Faculty. She's Maribeth Louise Hutchinson, and even 26 years later, I can still hear the distinctive cadence she uses to introduce herself. She was also Daisy Adair in the TV show Dead Like Me, Marie Warner on 24, Zoe Barnes on Defying Gravity, and basically she's just worked long and hard and built up a nice career for herself while studying social ecological systems design at UC Berkeley with a focus on addressing disparities in food access in low-income communities. In the role of recreational drug user and professional gross misogynist Steve, we have Danny Dyer, who's probably best known for Sweet Suffering Jesus, 1,156 episodes of EastEnders between 2013 and 2023. He plays Mick Carter, but I presume if you're enough of a fan for that name to mean anything to you, you're also enough of a fan to know that already, because he did over 1,000 episodes, and presumably the audience came to recognize him over that span. He was also a presenter on the game show The Wall, and he's done a load of other film and television work in smaller parts, but I figure that 1,100 episode run of EastEnders is probably where most people will connect him from. And last on our list, but among the first to appear on film, is David Gilliam as George, who's been acting since the 1970s. He was in the echo horror film Frogs, the TV movie John and Yoko A Love Story, and the Oscar-winning film Slumdog Millionaire, although he seems to have mostly retired from acting apart from a short film called Splashback in 2023. Surprisingly enough, he is not British, even though his accent in this movie sounds very much like the kind of unconvincing American accents I'm used to hearing on British film and television. If you're a British actor with a good American accent, you come over and do it for Hollywood. Look, I don't make the rules. And speaking of Gilliam, the film begins after the usual profusion of studio logos with his character George fleeing through the woods not far behind a pair of Hungarian sex workers, Olga and Nadia, played by Juliana Dryko and Judit Victor, respectively. This movie was shot in Hungary, and once you get past those main 8 cast members, you're gonna get a lot of local cast and crew. But Olga and Nadia fall into a pit trap, and rather than stop to help them out, George keeps right on running, stopping only when he runs headlong into a tree. Amusingly, the camera continues right along, stopping and slowly reversing course to show him nursing a bloody nose. There's a lot of very nice directorial flourishes in this film. Olga and Nadia take off their coats, tops, and even their bras to use them as an improvised grappling hook to try to climb their way out, and I think that you can tell a lot about the peculiarly mid-2000s brand of sexism and misogyny disguised as humor from this scene alone. I've talked about this before, most prominently in the 2017 film Happy Death Day that was a trunk script from 2007, but the aughts were an era when media tried very hard to sell us on the retrograde notion that we were now beyond the need for feminism, and that since women could be anything they wanted to be and do anything they wanted to do, then it was time to reclaim their sexuality by allowing themselves to be objectified by men. It was a brand of doublethink exemplified by The Man Show and the quote-unquote author Tucker Max, and you see a lot of it in the comedies of the era where women were put into the position of either having to sexualize themselves or be seen as an uncool prude. Sadly, "We have to show our breasts to escape this pit trap" is very on point for 2006, even though we won't actually see the actors nude until much later in the film. But we see George get his comeuppance right away as he steps into a snare trap and winds up hanging upside down like Scott in Friday the 13th Part 2. A killer steps into view wielding a vicious serrated knife, and even though he stabs George somewhere above camera height, we soon see the blood pouring down onto his face and then from there to the ground. The camera inverts, allowing us to see him as upright and the gushing blood flowing straight up in defiance of gravity as the title card drops. As always, the inversion of the camera represents an upending of the existing order of things, in this case promising a degree of misrule in which it's allowable to enjoy what would otherwise be horrific deaths because of the very unsympathetic and artificial nature of the characters involved. Over the opening credits, we see a chartered coach bus driving out into the Hungarian countryside, carrying employees of Palisades Defense. The seven employees are all watching their company's latest promotional video, starring George, who looks a lot more composed and collected and, alive than he did a few moments ago, with varying degrees of interest, with Steve sitting in the back and ordering himself some local romantic escorts for the corporate team-building retreat, while Richard dictates a memo to himself to congratulate George later on his fabulous performance. Of special note, the Palisades logo, a square crosshairs with the lower right-hand corner sliced off to form a dumpy and misshapen P, is so ugly that it made me viscerally angry to look at it. Which is, I presume, the intent, given that this was made squarely in the middle of the occupation of Iraq, when disdain for the Bush-era excesses of corporate rapaciousness in general and the brutal callousness of the military-industrial complex in particular were at their height, so well done to everyone on the production team. I'll get into the problems with making this a commentary on war profiteering and the gruesome indifference to human suffering in the defense industry as we go on, but suffice to say it's working at least conceptually for now. While Jill comments on the lack of diversity in the corporate video, which is a little rich coming from a film that has exactly one non-white character who doesn't even make it to the third act, but the aughts were an era where it was considered to be enough to identify and ironically comment on the problem of racism rather than fix it, Steve sneaks into the bathroom to smoke pot, setting off the smoke detectors and infuriating the bus's driver, who's played by Sandor Boros, the stunt driver for the production. As the video ends with George promising a victory in the war on terror, Harris sardonically comments, "I bloody hope not," a nice little jab at the mutual web of dependence on human suffering shared between the world's militaries and their various suppliers of arms and armaments. It's funny to me that genre can get away with this kind of social satire for the most part, whereas if you put it into a serious drama, it would be seen as too political for mainstream audiences. Yes, The Last Jedi caught some flack, but nobody seems to have caught on that the Iron Man trilogy is all about a defense contractor who develops a conscience, only to be attacked by the military, Congress, the terrorists, his corporate rivals, and even his own CFO, all of whom don't care who dies so long as the money keeps flowing in. As the coach heads further and further away from civilization, Steve decides to further his drug trip by chowing down on a handful of hallucinogenic mushrooms, and I feel like this is one of the places where the movie loses me for a few reasons. One, I think the writer and director both thought I would be much more enamored by Steve's quote-unquote charm, which mostly consists of taking drugs and making inappropriate sexual advances toward his coworkers, than I am or than anyone actually in the film would be. And two, because I've spent the better part of 15 years working in a corporate environment, and unless things are very different in the UK than they are here, I'm going to politely suggest that openly gulping drugs by the handful in full view of my boss at an official corporate function would be frowned upon, to say the least. This is a guy who literally expects to be sharing air with the actual CEO of his company within a few hours, and he's munching on some shrooms he got from a security guard without even knowing what the actual effects are going to be. It's incredibly unrealistic, and it took me right out of the film. The coach suddenly stops, and when everyone looks out front to see what the trouble is, they realize the road is blocked by a fallen tree. They don't get out and attempt to shift it, even though it looks just about manageable for a group of 8 people. Wonder if that's significant. And in another movie, I might call that a plot hole, but it feels entirely in keeping with this particular group of semi-competent office professionals who are used to their crises coming at them in slow motion and mostly on paper. They instead suggest to the driver that he should try an alternate route, and because none of them speak Hungarian, none of them understand that he's telling them the other road leads to a part of the countryside too risky to travel through. Because he's got no actual leadership skills, Richard tries his usual tactic of managing through intimidation. But the driver isn't one of his employees, and he responds to Richard's bluster by throwing all of their bags out onto the side of the road and leaving them behind when they get out to collect them. He turns the bus around and drives back the way he came, leaving the group with no choice but to take the detour on foot. Or, you know, walk around the tree and continue down the road they were already traveling on, but again, these are not people who are good in a crisis, and that's the whole point of the movie. Now, at this point, it's already very clear to anyone even remotely familiar with the horror genre what kind of movie we're in. Fallen trees and blocked roads are never truly accidental in a story like this, and any group of people wandering down a dirt road through isolated, impenetrable woods is just begging for an ambush. Which is why it's something of a surprise, and not a welcome one, when the only scares in this stretch of the movie are fake-outs. There's a growl in the distance, which prompts some comedy debate over whether there are bears in Hungary, and whether they're still technically in Hungary, and whether there are bears in Romania, and whether the bears in Romania know they're not allowed to enter Hungary, and Steve thinks he sees someone when he steps off the road to go to the bathroom, but everyone dismisses it because he's tripping balls on magic mushrooms. They find a building that they believe to be the corporate lodge where the retreat is to be held without meaningful incident, even though there's a great gag where a large brown bear walks across the road behind them and nobody notices. There are some funny jokes in this movie. There really are. I'm going to be kind of savaging it a little, and I just want to emphasize that. But this sequence is emblematic of the film's biggest problem. The first act is way too long. We all know where this is going. We all know that the fun of this film is going to come in watching the large cast of eminently disposable, almost entirely unsympathetic characters fuck up their responses to a serious crisis in a variety of comedic and fatal ways, and yet the filmmakers seem to believe that we really need to take more time and settle in and get to know all of the characters before the mayhem can begin. And unfortunately, that means enduring some gay panic banter between Billy and Steve while he's in the forest peeing, so let's just add that to the list of charming personality traits for the guy that, spoilers aside, is going to be one of our final survivors and is clearly being presented as a fun bloke with plenty of laddish wit and charm, and plenty of tension that slowly, slowly simmers when it needs to be boiling. The whole point of this is that these are stereotypical corporate drones and toadies, people we're not rooting for, so why do we have to hang out with them for 40 minutes or so before the plot can really kick off? That said, I do like the shot of Steve's urine splashing onto the face of a barely concealed corpse that he's too high to notice. It's a nice little hint at what's to come, even if it's not nearly enough to sustain us through the whole plotting first act. The group reaches what Richard insists is the newly purchased and renovated corporate lodge, even though it's obvious to everybody else that they've just broken into someone's home, and a fairly creepy someone to boot, but they're all tired from the long walk and none of them want to argue with their insecure and vindictive boss, despite the fact that the lodge is after the point where the two roads meet up again, so if they haven't reached another intersection, they have to have stopped too soon. So they decide to give up for the evening and sort out the potential questions of where the CEO is and why he isn't there waiting for them later. And by the way, McInerney is putting on a clinic here. He is just so convincingly smarmy and inept, a genuine well of meaningless corporate blather, and it really makes me feel like they missed out so much by not giving him a lot to do once the action kicks off. He mostly freezes in panic and terror, which is a shame because I want to see him spouting more platitudes like he does here about being unable to spell success without you. Steve is still tripping, and there's a visually inventive scene inspired by 2001 where he keeps looking over and seeing himself where he's going to be without remembering the actual travel involved. This went on for an extra 2 or 3 minutes in the deleted scenes, and I think they wisely kept it at a length that's clever without being exhausting. Especially because, I'll tell you right now, he fully comes down from his trip before anything happens in the movie, so the magic mushrooms don't actually contribute to the story at all. You could cut them completely, which would be a good idea because, as noted, there's a long stretch of this film where very little happens. Gordon and Harris go looking for a generator, and speaking of extended bits that contribute nothing to the plot, there's a gag where Gordon finds a leaf-choked swimming pool and bounces up and down on the diving board for 3, thankfully non-consecutive minutes, before falling in off-camera. It is infuriatingly pointless. Harris, meanwhile, finds not only the generator but the next plot point, a filing cabinet with a whole series of dossiers on Soviet war criminals stamped with the Palisades corporate logo. And that brings us to the film's second biggest problem, the connection between the murderers lurking in the woods and Palisades defense. Because, not to put too fine a point on it, when this script began in the mind of James Moran under the title of P-45, it wasn't about a defense contractor. It was just your garden variety, generic big corporation, the way The Office was about a paper company and the Apple TV series Severance is about a corporation so mysterious nobody knows what they do or why they do it. When Smith came on board, he decided to give it a political edge relevant to the era by making it specifically about a military contractor, and although it went through several more drafts after that, there was never what they call a page one rewrite, where the entire premise is rebuilt from the ground up around the new unifying principle of the story. Which means that in this new version, it's pure coincidence that these employees of Palisades Defense stumbled onto, spoilers, an abandoned mental institution where the Soviet Union kept their most vicious and unrepentant war criminals right up until the end of the Cold War, when their degrading bureaucracy lost track of them. And it's pure coincidence that the weapons supplied to the troops sent to hunt them down came from Palisades. And most unfortunately of all, it turns out to be pure coincidence that the survivors of the massacre blame not the Russian government, but the weapons manufacturer that made the guns, and they're now hunting this group not because of random sadism or cannibalistic instinct or any of the reasons they've hunted all the other people who stumbled into their territory in the last 15 years, but because they're filthy, filthy defense contractors who profit off of human misery. Needless to say, this dulls the initially honed satire to a catastrophic degree. It's hard to see this as any kind of meaningful critique of the military-industrial complex when literally the same thing would have happened if they were anyone else coming through this part of the Hungarian countryside at this particular time, and when, of all the people who might have some kind of a grudge against a weapons manufacturer, these are the lone individuals who aren't deserving of any kind of sympathy at all because they're violent sociopaths who even their own government couldn't keep from murdering entire villages of civilians out of pure mindless sadism. I feel like this needed a lot of reconsideration, a true page one rewrite, to make the murders a genuine result of the callousness of the company and not simply a bizarre series of happenstance events. I don't know, maybe they turn out to be hired killers, employed by the CEO to wipe out some employees he wants to get rid of so he doesn't have to pay their expensive severance packages. Which would at least explain the title, something that otherwise goes unaddressed. Whatever the solution, this reliance on chance and coincidence really makes the whole plot very hard to swallow. As evening falls, which feels like way too long for them to be literally inside the killer's house without anything happening, Richard falls asleep and has a sex dream about Maggie that turns into a nightmare when she is revealed to have Harris's face. Again, the aughts were all about misogyny and homophobia in a big way, although at least here it feels like it reveals something about Richard's tangled and insecure psyche, even though it will have exactly zero payoff later in the movie. Really, this whole first act becomes even more unforgivable on repeat viewings when you realize how little of it actually matters. While Gordon bakes everyone a meat pie, the group discusses the files Harris found and their connection to a series of conspiracy theories everyone has heard about the company they all work for. Harris tells a story, presented in the form of an old silent film from the 1920s, about a local Hungarian mental institution from before World War I where the patients attacked and locked up the doctors before Palisades came in and killed everyone at the behest of the government. This is agreed by the group to be deeply fucking stupid and nonsensical, and Jill tells the accurate version. When the Soviet Union broke up, some of the mental institutions where they kept their violent war criminals fell between the cracks, and the prisoners escaped. Palisades supplied the Russian troops who killed them, and any remaining survivors would have escaped into the woods to survive by whatever means they could. Oh, and fucking Steve says it was a hospital for rich, impotent old men who all had sexy nurses with pent-up sexual tension that was only released when a virile stranger who looked exactly like Steve showed up. Have I mentioned how very, very unlikable this man is, and how the filmmakers seem to think that I'm going to find him filled to the brim with rough-hewn charm? The conversation, which also includes an extremely awkward moment between Richard and Maggie that's obviously influenced by Richard's recent dream, is interrupted when Steve's bite of meat pie includes a human tooth complete with gold filling. Gordon admits that he found the pie in the fridge wrapped in foil and simply baked it up for the group without even considering what might be inside it, and the group reacts to the news that the owner of the house is actually a cannibal who might be back at any moment and they've all just eaten human flesh by... going to bed. No, seriously. The next scene is them all tucking in for the night and not, you know, grabbing their flashlights and running as fast as their legs will carry them in the opposite direction. I know I say that the big difference between the people watching a horror movie and the people appearing in one is that the people in the horror movie don't know they're in a horror movie, but once you've just chowed down on a big old plate of human remains, I kind of feel like you don't have that excuse anymore. This is just plain unbelievable. Jill wakes up in the middle of the night to get a glass of water, and I do not know why she thinks the water supply in this building is safe to drink, because I sure wouldn't, and the film makes a lot of two key points. One, there's a loose board on the floor in the upstairs hallway, and two, Jill has a huge honking spider crawling on her back. The former will come into play in the third act, and the latter is a ploddingly paced red herring because Jill turns out to be one of those people who like spiders. If you're familiar with the 1977 movie Kingdom of the Spiders, starring William Shatner, this is the same gag from the first act of that movie, and I suspect it's intentional. She goes to the window to let it out and is startled by the sight of someone up in the trees staring back at her. This, of all things, is the final straw for Harris, and he decides to head back in the morning and try to either get a cell phone signal or find someone who will come out and pick the rest of them up. Richard vetoes the plan, and when everyone overrules him, he escalates immediately to threats of firing if they don't respect his authority. This, of course, leaves him with nowhere else to go when they simply don't care, and he's forced to back down and suggest they all go to bed and sleep on it before they make any further decisions. Because that's really what this film needed at the 41-minute mark still bogged down in the first act. A good night's rest. The next morning, Richard's got a plan. He's going to send Harris and Jill back to either try to get a cell phone signal or find someone who will pick the rest of them up. And this gag really works. It's a note-perfect example of the kind of manager whose ego can't stand being upstaged by someone who's got better ideas and who has to steal every good decision and present it as his own rather than allow someone else to succeed in his stead. While Jill and Harris are gone, delivering some thuddingly obvious foreshadowing in the form of a debate over whether the victims of the guillotine survived long enough to know they were decapitated, real medical science is somewhat divided over the opinion, with most believing that you'd pass out from shock even if your brain would technically survive for a few minutes without oxygen, the others all engage in a round of paintball with Gordon as referee. But before they can find someplace high up enough to get a cell phone signal in the mountains, Jill and Harris find the bus stalled at the side of the road with the driver dead in a ditch. So that's about the 44-minute mark before we get anything approaching real horror or real action, and guess what? They then cut away from it to 3.5 minutes of paintball and some banter between Steve and Billy about fancying Maggie. I really think this movie needed some serious rewriting to get us to the second act faster, because it's where all the meat of the satire would have been. Thank God, and I of course would not say this about any real person or real injuries, that Gordon steps into a bear trap at the 47.5 minute mark and the movie can finally get going. Steve and Billy try to pry it back open again so that Maggie can pull him out, but Steve turns out to be thoroughly incompetent and Richard is frozen in shocked horror, so they actually wind up shearing his entire leg off just below the knee. This is, of course, the exact opposite of how real bear traps, which are all about preventing the animal from getting away by digging in with blunt force trauma and spikes, would actually work, but who knows, maybe this one was deliberately sharpened to sever limbs. Maggie uses Billy's belt as an improvised tourniquet to stop the bleeding, but not before a spray of arterial blood gushes onto Richard's paint gun. He hurls it aside and it lands in another bear trap. The whole area is riddled with them, and Gordon was just the unlucky first victim. Just then, Jill and Harris pull up in the bus, and they narrowly manage to evade the remaining traps and collect Gordon's leg to be reattached later, shoving it in the fridge in the bus in what feels like the beginning of a running gag, but isn't. The group drives back the way they came, but an unseen individual tosses a set of spiked chains onto the road, and Harris loses control when he hits them, flipping the bus clean onto its side. This was actually the stunt driver's idea. The original crash was supposed to be lower speed and less spectacular, but according to Smith, the Hungarian crew was fairly reckless about their own personal safety, and Boros insisted on doing this stunt crash at 50 miles per hour instead of 35. He was knocked out by the impact, but suffered no serious injuries. Gordon sustains a broken arm in the crash to go with his severed leg, while Jill is heavily concussed and wanders away from the impact in a scene that feels like it's breaking some fairly elementary rules of directing. She sits up and looks around, then we get what seems to be an establishing shot of the outside of the coach, then when it cuts back to her, she's inside the coach, leaving us wondering exactly what position she's occupying. A few more cuts to the outside make us realize that we're getting a POV shot from the killer's perspective as he watches her wake up and stumble off in a daze, but it's very unclear at first, and I can't help thinking there must have been a better way of doing this. Jill finds an injured and immobile Harris, but she's so addled by the crash she just waves to him and wanders deeper into the woods. He is then decapitated by a mysterious stranger with a machete, and wouldn't you know it, he sees his own body a few feet away in the minutes before oxygen deprivation claims him. Also, it's a cookbook. But he can't read it, because he broke his glasses. Jill's the killer's next victim, and the others wake up to find her missing and Harris dead. Without any other options beyond fleeing through the woods in the middle of the night with a killer on their tail, they return to the lodge. I think I'd have liked this a little better if I didn't feel like we just spent 35 unnecessary minutes at the lodge. The killer ties Jill to a tree, then shouts at her in a language she doesn't recognize before finishing with the word Palisades. He douses her with lighter fluid and tries to strike a match, but the brief flicker of hope Jill has when he's unable to get it to burn dies out, as does she, when he pulls out a flamethrower and burns her alive. It's a surprisingly mean death after 58 minutes of faffing around with sub-office hijinks, and I think this is another problem with starting the second act so late. If the whole movie had been gruesome violence interspersed with dark comedy, we'd be ready for death by flamethrower. But because we spend almost the first half of the movie bumbling around with paintball and meat pies, this kind of comes out of left field. The survivors get back to the lodge and board themselves in using the supplies the ludicrously overprepared Gordon brought with him. This is an actual joke. I'm not complaining about how ludicrously overprepared Gordon is. Steve gives Gordon some of his ecstasy, the closest we ever get to a payoff about all of the drug stuff, and it takes away a little of his pain, although to be honest, the idea that he'd even be conscious after all this kind of strained credulity for me. Maggie and Steve share the beginnings of a tender moment with him apologizing for his constant stream of crude and inappropriate comments, but it crashes and burns when he realizes he forgot to grab Gordon's lower leg. There's a slightly clumsy gag involving Gordon having a very stereotypical ecstasy high, and then Billy goes off to use the bathroom, delivering the line, "Don't worry, I'll be right back," almost directly to camera. So you can count Scream among the movies this film is homaging. Maggie and Steve sit down at the table together to discuss Gordon's medical situation, and apparently it's so serious it's affected both their hearing and peripheral vision as someone walks through the room right behind them and picks up Gordon by the shoulders before dragging him back the way he came. I understand that they're supposed to be dismissing this as plumbing sounds from upstairs, but there's a point where Maggie looks directly at where the killer has to be, and in the real world you can tell gurgling noises from overhead apart from loud scraping noises right behind you. This is another moment that took me out of the film, although it should be said that by then my patience may have been a little strained by that unbearably lengthy first act. Maggie suggests leaving Gordon behind to get help, but just then Billy comes back and notices that the semi-conscious invalid is missing. There's then a shot that inadvertently breaks the rule of 180 as we cut away to Gordon being woken by his tormentor and then cut back to Steve and Maggie from the other side of the table just as they're turning in their seat, so it looks like the geometry of the room has reversed itself. I had to rewind this scene and watch it again just to orient myself spatially. The group follows the bloody drag marks to a hidden basement, filled with the cells where the inmates of the institution were once held, where the killer makes his lair. And in one of the cells, the killer sets down his machete point first before carving the Palisades logo into Gordon's chest. I just can't stop being amused by the implication that the cannibal murderer would have totally let this gang go if they weren't in a bus with the company name on it. Oh no, no, it's fine. I actually kill very few people on this stretch of deserted road filled with traps for the unwary. I mostly just hang out here in the hopes that I'll happen upon the people who supplied the weapons to the people who hunted me down after I was locked up for my many, many war crimes. I love how very much sense my motives make, don't you? Gordon dies, and when Maggie and Billy stumble on the killer and he fires on them with his shotgun, Richard and Steve run back the way they came. Billy and Maggie hide in a cell while the killer pursues Richard and Steve, but it's too late for Billy. He took a round to the chest, and he dies in Maggie's arms in a legitimately sad scene. It's especially sad because the only other person to express a romantic interest in Maggie is Steve, and that means he's probably going to survive. Finding her inner badass, Maggie collects the machete from the cell and decides to hunt the man who's hunting her. She goes back up into the house just as Steve finds a place to hide in the closet, and Richard flees out into the night only to step on a landmine manufactured by his own company, a P-114, which is the first of a couple of references to Dr. Strangelove. Which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because in the corporate video from the beginning this is presented as one of their newest products, and not something that fugitive Soviet war criminals would find in an abandoned weapons depot from the 1990s, but that just feels like water over the dam at this point. The killer hunts Steve, stepping on the loose floorboard and turning it into a hole in the floor that goes all the way to the next level down. Steve gives the murderer the slip and finds the knife Richard was using earlier to cut cheese. Maggie tries to sneak up on the killer, but falls through the hole in the floor and goes crashing down to the lower level. The killer comes up to the edge and sees her lying there stunned, pointing his gun at her for a lethal shot, but then Steve stabs him in the back and he goes falling down to crash halfway through into the basement. Maggie finishes him off with a shot to the head, just to make sure he won't come after them again, and together the two remaining survivors head out of the cabin and down the road to safety. Which is where all the movie's other problems really come back to haunt it, for me at least. Because as you've noticed from all the mentions of the 10-minute mark and the 40-minute mark and the 45-minute mark and the 50-minute mark, I spent my first viewing so frustrated with the misshapen plot structure and the erratic pacing that I checked the time code pretty frequently. Which means that unlike anyone viewing this in theaters, I had a pretty good idea that there was still 25 minutes left in the movie when the inspirational strings started up and Maggie and Steve leaned on each other in quiet, familiar intimacy as they made their way back to civilization. Which means that when the film does pull off its actually genuinely great twist that there are still 7 more murderous cannibals to deal with and they're all waiting right outside for Maggie and Steve, I kinda saw it coming. Still a great twist, though. For the record, the 8 killers are the Lodge Killer, played by Levente Toccoli, the Flamethrower Killer, played by Janos Ola, the Head Squish Killer, played by Attila French, the Headbutt Killer, played by Bella Cassi, the Knife in Butt Killer, played by Roland Kolarski, the Stone Thrower Killer, played by Peter Katona, the Landmine Killer, played by Levent Lesak, and the Big Gun Killer, played by Nick Greenall. Needless to say, some of these unusual monikers will make more sense as the movie goes on. Reacting quickly, Maggie shoots the Big Gun Killer, who's got a very large gun, in the head with the last bullet in the shotgun she's holding. She then bluffs the remaining 5, the Flamethrower Killer isn't with the group at the moment, with her empty gun before she and Steve make a run for it. They come upon Richard, still standing on top of a landmine that will kill him and anything nearby if he moves, and he helps them find a safe path through the minefield before shouting to attract the attention of the murderous mob. I don't love, by the way, that there are not one but 2 scenes in this movie that establish a ground full of deadly traps for the unwary, only to have absolutely no tension as both groups immediately find their way through without any missteps or hazard. But the killers don't bother attacking, knowing that he's a dead man already, and brazenly walk right past him using a fallen tree to avoid the other mines. One of them throws a rock at Richard, hoping to knock him off balance, but he withstands it. See? The names just make more and more sense as we go. And after fleeing through the woods for what can't be more than a few minutes, Steve and Maggie stumble on the actual Palisades Lodge, where George is entertaining himself with the local escorts that Steve hired back at the beginning of the movie. Which means first, that the cold open actually happens after everything we've seen up until now, and second, that the Palisades Lodge, which is labeled Palisades in big letters on the front that cannot be from the last 2 days, is within walking distance of the horde of no less than 8 cannibal murderer war criminals who blame this company for everything bad that ever happened to them, and who rejoice at the thought of finding and torturing its employees, and they haven't so much as gone to take a look at it this entire time. Needless to say, I was not impressed by this particular screenwriting contrivance, and I will leave it at that. Steve and Maggie burst in, warning them of the 5 people hunting them and not realizing that Richard has decided to sacrifice himself to blow up 2 of the killers as they pass by. McInerney plays it with quite a bit of nobility, which is maybe more than the character deserves, but is nonetheless pretty darn cool. George decides that as a white man with a big masculine penis extension of a weapon, he's not letting anyone threaten him on his own turf, and he pulls out an honest-to-God rocket launcher to use on what he calls the terrorists. A bit on the nose, perhaps, but genuinely accurate in portraying the way these people think. But in one of the most darkly comedic moments in the film, when George launches the missile, it ignores the remaining killers and goes straight after a passenger jet flying by overhead. It takes out the airplane, which technically makes this one of the highest body count movies I've ever covered, and everyone is forced to run for their lives. Which leads us to George's death and Olga and Nadia's imprisonment in the pit trap, as we've already seen, and now we're all caught up and ready for the denouement. Maggie is also caught in a snare trap just like George, and when Steve doubles back to help her, he's attacked by a second killer. The 2 of them fight, with Steve doing a surprisingly good job of handling himself against the former Soviet war criminal for a guy who works at an office job and does a lot of drugs, and he manages to get the man's knife away from him and shove it up into his butt. This doesn't kill him immediately, but it's probably not good for him in the long term, and it definitely reduces his will to fight. Maggie's approached by another killer, the same one who murdered George with the serrated knife, but he cuts Maggie down so he can sexually assault her before he kills her. And I mean, I'm not going to pretend for a moment that this is an even remotely implausible development, because the history of warfare is filled with horrific incidents of soldiers forcing themselves on civilian women, but coming as it does 15 minutes before the end of the movie, I kind of feel like it's a little late to get into this kind of gross and sexualized peril, even if it does lead to a pretty nice moment where Maggie grabs a rock and clocks him across the head with it, then grabs another much larger rock and drops it on him to, you guessed it, squish his head. Steve, meanwhile, is attacked by the 3rd killer and manages to get his gun away from him. He shoots him, but the man with the knife in his butt manages to throw a 2nd knife that goes straight into Steve's chest just above his heart. Steve knocks the killer down, sending the knife deeper into his buttock and putting him out of commission, and staggers away. Maggie, meanwhile, sees something in the woods, and this is another place where I really have to ding the director, because he apparently thought that an indistinct shape of a human head and a flickering flame would tell me that, oh man, it's the flamethrower killer from earlier, and Maggie's look of shock and horror is her realizing she's still in mortal danger. But in fact, the shot is so brief and so confusing that I honestly thought the first time I saw it that I was looking at Jill's body, and Maggie was just reacting in dismay to the final confirmation of her friend's death. So maybe Smith's shot composition gets a little bit clearer by the time Triangle rolls around? Anyway, she runs off shouting for Steve. But he's nearly spent. He collapses next to a tree, pulling the knife out, which is exactly what you're not supposed to do, but as always in movies, this renders the wound irrelevant for the rest of the film, and is surprised to see an improvised grappling hook composed of coats, bras, and a piece of wood come flying up from the hole next to him. He crawls over to see 2 topless sex workers, and I think the movie wants me to be titillated by our laddish hero's sudden discovery of hot, sexy women, but I really just wanted him to rescue them and then bleed to death. As always, getting a response out of your audience is an art and not a science. Maggie finds some railway tracks and follows them to the Palisades Supply Depot the killers have been raiding to get their weapons. It's also abandoned because the post-communist Eastern Bloc governments weren't always great about tracking what happened to their predecessors' stuff, and there's even a working phone for Maggie to use to call the police. But the first person she talks to doesn't speak English, and so Maggie is put on hold while she hides for her life, in another one of the film's genuinely good jokes. There are some. I'm serious. Deciding she can't wait any longer, she goes back out into the open only to find the flamethrower killer waiting for her. A tense chase ensues through the abandoned buildings, ending with Maggie trying to jump down from the second story only to injure her leg. But just as things look their grimmest, Nadia shows up with her coat covering her otherwise bare breasts and firing Steve's assault rifle in a shot directly stolen from Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. I think every director does this, and every director who's not Quentin Tarantino eventually gets it out of their system. The four of them go down to the lake and climb into a rowboat to row somewhere better, I guess? Look, this part doesn't make much sense, but the movie's almost over, so just go with it. And for a moment, it looks like all my dreams are about to come true as Steve goes limp in Maggie's arms. But he recovers, asking Maggie if she wants to have a foursome in what could be the most repugnant moment ever presented as comedy in any of the movies I've ever covered for this podcast, and the credits roll. To the tune of We'll Meet Again, in another and far more obvious nod to Dr. Strangelove that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense in this context because all of the cannibals are dead or dying and they very much won't meet them again. Ever. But again, sometimes directors just need to get this thing out of their system. And so do the writers. Which may be the motto of this movie in a nutshell. And will I hang on to this movie? No, I don't think so. It's not an unalloyed failure, and honestly I would love to see it remade because the premise of Wrong Turn Meets the Office is a great one that really merits re-examination. But it's slow and draggy, it's incredibly misogynistic in ways that sadly reflect the entire era it was made in, and the satire really needs to be honed a lot to dig into its intended targets. That's a lot of flaws for one movie, and unfortunately I think together they combine to be a fatal one. So it's back to the shelf, even though I'm glad I saw it and discovered exactly what it had to offer. And if you want to talk about extensive shot-by-shot homages, the alternate ending where they all rode directly over the edge of a waterfall, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as Half Price Horror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, I promised y'all a mutant baby courtroom sequence, and dammit, I'm a man of my word. So let's return to Larry Cohen and his It's Alive series one last time to watch the movie that inspired Jurassic Park 2, and I'm not even kidding. It's Alive 3. Island of the Alive. See you then.